Rogers Hornsby once said, "People ask me what I do in winter when there's no baseball. I'll tell you what I do. I stare out the window and wait for spring." He was lying, you know. There were a lot of things that Rogers Hornsby didn't do. He didn't read books because they might be hard on your eyes. He didn't go to the movies because they too might strain your batting eye. In fact, later in his career, when he was retired and managing the St. Louis Browns, one of his players said, "You know, you can go now, Raj. They don't flicker anymore. They're a lot better than they used to be." But no, he was just limited. But not that limited. Maybe he did not choose to exercise his brain or anything else for that matter. He just stared out the window and waited for spring. But the window was often at the track and he was waiting for spring while watching the ponies go in little circles. I don't think that helped him any because he was famous for accruing losses. It got him in trouble sometimes. And maybe if he had a more compelling alternative interest, he would have been less addicted to gambling. As much as you love our great game as much as I do, as much as Hornsby was good at it, I don't say that he loved it. Do you think it's possible that had he had a better psychological relationship to it and to the rest of his life, and had spent fewer winter days staring out of windows and waiting for Rabbit Moranville to see his shadow, that he might have been even better? I realize I'm saying a lot. I realize that this is a fellow who won 7 batting titles and hit .358 lifetime. But he might have enjoyed it more, which would have made him a better person to be around, which would have meant that he wasn't traded 16 times, or that the St. Louis Browns wouldn't have bought owner Bill Veeck a thank you gift when he fired Hornsby as their manager. Now, to be fair, that was a really tasteless publicity stunt in which Veeck bought himself a loving cup, but given the fact that one of Hornsby's tactics for expressing his displeasure with a player was to go into the shower and pee on them, I think it's fair to assume that Veeck might have accurately captured the sentiment of the roster as a whole. It's better to have perspective in all things, don't you think? There's an anecdote about a Groucho Marx ad-lib on the game show You Bet Your Life, which is almost certainly apocryphal, that Groucho was interviewing a contestant, a woman named Mrs. Story, who supposedly had a large number of children, double-figure numbers of children, and Groucho said, "Why have so many?" And she responded, "I love children and I love my husband." "Madam," Groucho supposedly shot back, "I love my cigar too, but I take it out of my mouth every once in a while." Even if the story is not true, it's good advice, everything in moderation. And that brings me back to Hornsby. You know that you can never be too sure about book titles. Who picked them, I mean. The publisher hashes it over constantly with salespeople and marketing people, and you could have written, "Dick and Jane go to school with their dog Spot," and the publisher will consider your manuscript and insist that you publish it under the title, "Satan Comes to Death Town." So in telling you that Hornsby's autobiography was titled My War with Baseball, I urge you to take that title with a grain of salt. However, I do think it was accurate. And I think, well, what if it's true? I don't feel good about that. If it's that unpleasant for you, why would you want to keep doing it? And why would I want to watch it? You name the player. I don't care about the level of excellence. Mike Trout on offense, Andrelton Simmons on defense, just to name a couple. Young Ronald Acuna. I don't want to see them if I have the knowledge that every moment of this is pure misery for them. Rogers Hornsby retired decades before I was born, but I think I'd feel the same way. You know, if you'd rather be a lumberjack, I wholly encourage you to go be a lumberjack. Do not be a baseball player for my entertainment. I don't want that kind of responsibility for your life. I know I've talked about this more than once on this show, and I'm very self-conscious and aware of the possibility of boring you by repeating myself, but it's important to me, and it seems relevant here. 39 years ago this month, John Lennon and Yoko Ono put up posters in major cities all over the world at their expense. In big letters, "War is over!" If you want it, in smaller letters, and then below that, "Happy Christmas from John and Yoko." As you are probably used to hearing at this time of year, there's also a song that went with that campaign. The song itself is not great because its politics are very vague and nonspecific. Obviously, when we're talking about Happy Christmas and peace and all that in 1969, we're making reference primarily to the Vietnam War. But Lennon didn't say so. He kept it more generalized. And therefore, I think the part of the song that's most powerful is sung by Yoko and a children's chorus, and it's the part that just repeats the poster, "War is over if you want it." And along those same lines, though it may not always feel that way, you have a lot of power over your own life and over yourself. And if you are having a war with baseball in any sense, well then stop it. Cut it out. War is over if you want it. Find something healthier to do. It's only a game, remember? I'm Stephen Goldman, and this is The Infinite Inning. Welcome to a holiday episode of the show, a shortened mini-episode version, although we know me well enough by now to know that it won't be that short. No guests this time around, just me with a couple of tales and discussion points for you to mull over, as usual. And then next week, once we're past all this holiday business, this Christmas and New Year stuff, we will begin the New Year correctly, by returning Cliff Corcoran in his regular rotation spot, and we'll find out if he got any new baseball caps to add to his collection over the course of the holidays. I know he got one, but I can't say how I know. More importantly, we'll catch up on any baseball happenings, news, transactions, and so forth that we haven't yet discussed on the show, but promise to shatter the foundations of the 2019 baseball season. Why that would be a good thing, I don't know, but stay tuned for that next time. I wanted an excuse, by way of a story, and perhaps vice versa, to alert you to a documentary that is sort of out now, or was briefly out, and will be out again in the new year. It was a special limited release on just a couple of days. I am talking about They Shall Not Grow Old, a First World War documentary brought to you by Peter Jackson, director famous for Lord of the Rings and perhaps infamous for the bloated Hobbit trilogy as well. And what I want to convey to you is that if this is the sort of thing that you like, then that is probably the sort of thing that you will like as well. 4 or 5 years ago, the Imperial War Museum asked Jackson to produce a film marking the anniversary of the end of the war, which was, as you know, the 11th hour of the 11th day of the 11th month of this year, precisely 100 years ago. The stipulation was that he not create something out of whole cloth, but rather that he utilize the many dozens of hours of footage from the First World War that the museum possessed. The problem, as you can imagine, is that by definition, said film is very old and has suffered a lot of damage in one way or another. And as curious as we might be to have a window into the past, it can try our patience. Another reason for that, and this is inherent to the process at the time, was that the cameras were hand-cranked. They weren't plugged in anywhere or run on a battery or anything. And one person will crank at a different speed than someone else. So the frame rates were all over the place. And that's why those pictures look jerky and everybody moves very, very fast. What Jackson was able to do was clean up the film, insert the proper number of frames so that the humans move like humans. He colorized them about as well as anything I've ever seen colorized. It's not obtrusive or artificial looking. Dubbed in as many authentic sounds as possible, in part because Jackson seems to have a private collection of World War I artillery and other memorabilia in his possession. And finally, they even retained forensic lip readers to try to understand what it is that the people 100 years ago were saying to these silent cameras. In a way that is reminiscent of an effect achieved in The Wizard of Oz, The picture begins with these old, uncorrected, tattered remnants from over 100 years ago, and then about 15 minutes in, shifts to the restored footage. And I cannot tell you when the last time I actually went in a movie theater. It's possible that I never have, which is ironic, I guess, because as I've gotten older, special effects have gotten better and better and more prevalent, and I go see a lot of those films, a lot of the genre films and superhero films and stuff. But weirdly, the more realistic they get and the more prevalent they become, the more aware of them I am. And it becomes very difficult for my willing suspension of disbelief to work when you're aware that if you've, say, gone to a Jurassic Park picture, although I'm not sure why you would at this stage, but still, say you had, and you realize that it's just Chris Pratt and Bryce Dallas Howard endlessly in front of a green screen running away from pixels that aren't really there. Or if you watch a Marvel film and you enjoy the presence of Robert Downey Jr. and the presence of Iron Man, really you're trading one for the other every time, because as soon as Iron Man appears, Robert Downey Jr. is out back having a smoke. But the restoration and enhancement work in They Shall Not Grow Old is very different, because it's not in the service of unreality. It's in the service of scraping away the stuff that distances the past from us, the grime and decay and just the limitations of technology at the time, and bringing it closer. And I was really stunned, because the effect is like that of a time machine. He also made a very wise decision not to have Ken Burns-style talking heads, no Shelby Foote interrupting the action with his praise of Robert E. Lee and Stonewall Jackson, but instead he used recordings from oral histories of the war. These were actual veterans recorded in the 1960s and 1970s by the BBC, so he's giving you their firsthand recollections over the footage that I just described, and it really is a great way of changing your sense of the war. It's very focused on the British Expeditionary Force experience. There is nothing about the Americans, not a lot even about the extended British Empire soldiers. He wanted to focus in just on the experience of this one group, so it wasn't kind of thematically all over the place, and I think that's a fine choice. It is what it is. And I say that not in the usual dismissive or resigned way, but in the sense that it's his film and this is how he chose to focus it, and I think that's fine. There can be other times for other aspects of the war. It's a huge thing. It was different things for different people in different places. And this particular experience, which follows these soldiers from the outbreak of the war, being drafted, being trained, being shipped overseas, the experience of battle, and the experience of it winding down, I think that's a very valid point of view. And perhaps it shouldn't be shocking that these fellows were not maudlin, because they're the ones who survived, and they're the ones who were well out of it by the time that they got interviewed. So you might expect that they would sound like a Siegfried Sassoon or Wilfred Owen poem, but they don't. Some of them are rather chipper about the experience and talked about how much they enjoyed it. But, you know, I referenced Ken Burns before. That comes up at the end of his Civil War documentary, too. Some of the soldiers look back on it as this great time, because there is nothing that a human cannot retroactively infest with nostalgia. The forensic lip reading thing came up in my reading of Jane Levy's book, which we discussed last week, her Babe Ruth book, The Big Fella, because there was relatively recently unearthed some home movie footage of the Babe clowning around on this 1927 barnstorming tour, which provides the book with its framework. There really isn't a great deal of off-the-field footage of the Babe, particularly in his prime, and so, since there are some shots in that home movie footage of the Babe talking to the camera, it seemed worthwhile to hire one of these forensic lip readers and figure out what it was that he was saying. What would we learn about the Babe and his thoughts, his fears, his emotions? To spoil this one tiny aspect of the book, they got the lip reader in there. Ruth turns to the camera, his mouths move, and the lip reader read what he said. "Turn that fucking thing off." With one notable exception in the film, the forensic lip reading of the old World War One material is very similar. It turns out that people did not break out into Shakespearean speeches when some guy came around cranking a camera. It was almost the opposite. They tended to freeze up and just be like, hey, ha ha, ha ha ha. Having said that, I think baseball, whether it's Major League Baseball Productions or the network or the Hall of Fame Museum, somebody has got to get up some money and get some of the same people working on old baseball footage, because there is footage of Babe Ruth and Ty Cobb and so on the field. I don't see why it can't be cleaned up just as this footage was, placed in an appropriate frame rate so that they look like they're playing baseball instead of doing that mincing little trot around the bases at high speed that Babe Ruth does. And there's even an equivalent source of sound material, maybe not quite so much, but I recall a documentary a long time ago, I had it on video cassette, of the glory of their times, which used Lawrence Ritter's interview recordings over still photos of those old players, as well as some crunchy old video of the kind that Jackson restored. Well, you can see where we might go with that. As I was talking here, I just checked YouTube for that video, and it is there. Legally or not, I don't know, but it's in very good shape. It's not like an eighth generation dub of it, so check that out. I'll leave a link in the Facebook group. As you might expect, given my peculiar psychosis, which is that I see connections to baseball in just about everything, I kept thinking, in spite of the film's monofocus on these Britishers and their experience on the Western Front, of the American experience in the same place. If you've been with the show for a while, you might recall that way back in episode 17, I interviewed Jim Leake, author of the book From the Dugout to the Trenches, which was about the ballplayer experience in the First World War, and we discussed rather briefly, I think, Hank Gowdy, the Boston Braves catcher who was the first active ballplayer to join up. The first former or inactive ballplayer was the Giants infielder Eddie Grant, who had recently retired to take up a career in law. Harvard Eddie, they called him. Gowdy was a good player, but by no means a Yogi Berra or Gary Carter. His career straddled the dead ball and live ball eras. He generally was not an everyday starter, but then few catchers at that time were. But spotted well, he could hit a little bit. He averaged only .270 with a .351 on base and a .358 slugging for his career. When you figure that he spent a good chunk of his career at Boston's Braves Field, which was just an extreme pitcher's park, and that coincided also with the dead ball, you can cut him a little slack, and you realize that the averages I quoted to you are league average or a little better. But at the end of his career, he spent 3 seasons in a part-time role with the New York Giants, and he got 517 plate appearances, which is just about a full season for a catcher, I guess. And this is in the Polo Grounds with the Lively Ball, 1923, 24, 25, which is a much better deal. And he hit .321 with a .408 on base and a .454 slugging, which would make you a star if you could do it on an ongoing basis. But of course, he couldn't, and he didn't, and he wasn't. But despite that, despite the fact that he only played 1,050 games and had, what, 738 hits, he got some not insubstantial Hall of Fame support during his time on the ballot. And the reason for that is simple. And it's that at a time when ball players were resisting joining the colors and going off to fight the Hun, and they were by no means alone in their desire to skip a war that the American case for participation in was not altogether clear and was not well articulated by President Wilson. And finally, the government told ball players, work or fight, but you're done just being an athlete. You've got to contribute to the national war effort. Gowdy was the one guy who didn't have to be told. And when World War II came around, he went and he enlisted again. He was too old to see action in the Second World War, but they took him and they used him. But in the First World War, oh my, did he see action. And it was dangerous stuff because the Americans, and particularly the commanding general, Black Jack Pershing, more about whom in a moment, had to learn some of the lessons for themselves that the Europeans had been learning since 1914, namely, don't run at the machine guns. Pershing would say things like, "Superior rifle work will win this war," while German artillerymen on the heights across the way were saying, "Rifle this, jerk," and blowing up whole platoons of soldiers at once. And that lack of thought on the leadership's part, which is a feature of every war, but in particular this war, is what made Gaudi a real hero for signing up, because there was no guarantee that he'd be used well or appropriately or safely. And baseball was very proud of this guy, which is why the things that made him a Hall of Fame candidate back in the 1950s should still apply today. And that's especially true in a post-Harold Baines era when we're defining downward the meaning of what it takes to be in the Hall of Fame, but defining it in the right direction, because greatness is determined by more than just statistics. I want to talk a little bit more about that lack of care by the leadership and its impact on Gaudi, because life is not always fair, and the paths of glory lead only to the latrine. This is one of my stranger connections yet, but I hope you'll bear with me. We'll get into that right after this break.
Mr. Zip, 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 with your haircut just as short as mine. Good morning, Mr. Zip, 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 you sure are looking fine. Ashes to ashes, dust to dust, shaved tails don't get your top kicks must. Good morning, Mr. Zip, 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 with your haircut just as short as, your haircut just as short as, your haircut just as short as mine.
You're listening to Bing Crosby take on one of the authentic First World War songs, a soldier song, Good Morning, Mr. Zip, Zip, Zip. It refers to the haircuts, and it was published in 1918. Possibly to avoid offending sponsors, Bing cleans up the lyrics here. The originals were ashes to ashes and dust to dust. If the camels don't get you, the Fatimas must. Both refer to cigarettes. It's amazing the things that we knew about cigarettes before we decided we didn't know them. We'll pause for this brief interruption, and then we'll be back with, well, more of me, I guess. Hang in there, please, and watch out for snipers.
Let's have the servicemen here in the hall and everybody else everywhere climb right in on this next chorus. Here we go now. Everybody sing out loud and clear.
Good morning, Mr. Zip, 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 with your haircut just as short as mine. Good morning, Mr. Zip, 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 you're surely looking fine. Ashes to ashes and dust to dust.
As part of his focus on the individual soldier's story, Jackson spends a great deal of time on the inconveniences that the ordinary soldier suffered in the course of the war, and by inconveniences, I'm talking about rats, infestations of bodily lice, and communal defecation, which I would skip past, except that that's also where All Quiet on the Western Front begins, so it must have been significant. I used to think that Eric Maria Remarque, in starting his book there, just wanted to shock the reader, but maybe it's not just shocking. It's a really important thing to know, a good leading indicator as to how the war affected these people and also how they were treated. And I'm not saying that every soldier should have had his own private powder room, because of course that's not logistically realistic. But what I'm talking about is that for some of these cantonments, they just dug a hole in the ground and they put a board over it with holes in the board. And if you do get out to see this picture, then you will see more images of bare asses on planks than you've probably viewed to this point in your life. Well, most of you anyway. But while it's sort of gross, think about the greater implications of that. The First World War was the culmination of the Industrial Revolution's devaluation of the original. Too large a part of the Western population had been reduced to their role in serving these kind of carnivorous factories and deadly mines and so on. Even the Titanic, which sank in 1912 and therefore is very much part of this era, was a huge, negligently constructed machine that ate its passengers in the same way that the meatpacking plants described in Upton Sinclair's The Jungle, which was a 1904 book, so still broadly within this period, tended to turn the odd worker into sausages. You can see this sense of men being the servant of industry rather than the other way around in movies like Fritz Lang's 1927 Metropolis and Charlie Chaplin's 1936 Modern Times. Well, those pictures come out of the war, in a sense. I mean, they come out of the experience of the whole Industrial Revolution, too. But I think there's a direct analogy to the Western Front. As I said earlier, the war was fought in a lot of places, and it was a different experience depending on where you were and what you were doing. But the Western Front was an abattoir in which men were fed into this machine. They ran at these guns and the gun shot them down, and then they repeated it in essentially mechanical fashion. The most famous example of this is the 1916 Battle of the Somme, and in particular the first day, July 1st, when the British suffered over 57,000 casualties and over 19,000 killed. The generals, or the factory managers, were goal-oriented, and the soldiers, the people, the humans, were a means to that end. When you use any tool, it suffers wear. A knife becomes dull, a baseball bat can crack or break, and an army undergoes attrition. And we understand that that's going to happen, that if there is a war, if it is judged morally or politically necessary, we do understand that the purpose of soldiers in some cases is to die for the cause. But whereas we don't worry about the damage we're doing to the knife or the bat because ultimately they're inanimate objects, if you treat people the same way, the consequence is that Mrs. Brown's dear little boy Willie is never going to come home again. And unless you're a total unfeeling monster, you want that sacrifice to have been meaningful. So to get back to where we started, why did Peter Jackson make a point of showing this latrine activity of all the things he could have shown? And why did Remarque start the greatest novel of the First World War with a scene of the comrades in arms happily pooping away in the sun and rejoicing in that activity? I think it's because when you're an individual, you practice certain things in private, or most of us do, particularly those biological moments when we feel most vulnerable. It's an interesting question as to whether this sense of privacy that we have is a more recent invention of Western civilization in particular, or whether the primitive proto-humans, the rapidly balding gorillas that came down from the trees a quarter of a million years ago, were furtively sneaking off to the bushes to do their reproductive and excretory business, hopefully not at the same time. Or did that sense evolve later? Any anthropologists in the audience, call in now. Our lines are open. 11th caller wins a subscription to one of several true crime podcasts that does not spend a 10 or 15 minute digression about pooping 1914 style in the midst of a baseball story. Just to add to what I mean by the lack of care by the leadership and Pershing in particular, as I said earlier, the war ended on November 11th, 1918. Pershing knew that as of early that morning, if not before, that the Germans had asked for an armistice, and they had already agreed to some fairly draconian terms to get the war turned off. They just couldn't do it anymore. The Kaiser had abdicated, the army and navy were in revolt, everybody was dying of flu, there was rioting on the home front because they were starving. They were done. They had been winning a very short time before, but they were throwing in their cards. Nevertheless, on that morning, Pershing ordered attacks all up and down the line. Now, he did not believe in the armistice. He thought that the Allies should have chased the Germans all the way back to Berlin, and it's hard to say that he was wrong, given the way the next 20 years played out. However, there would have been a high cost to that. There's that, too. More little Willie's not going home. And regardless of what he did on the morning of November 11th, that was not going to be on offer. It was settled, at least for the time being. There would be a more involved post-war settlement later, but as of that moment, there was nothing more to be gained in combat. But Pershing attacked anyway. There were between 3,000 and 4,000 American casualties that day. Perhaps 10% of them died. there was no need for it whatsoever, and he knew that. He threw their lives away. And at the risk of being too on the nose with this analogy, Pershing just didn't give a shit, and therefore the latrines, well, you get the idea. The point is that there were all kinds of negations of the individual in this war, that people just became keys that you were trying to force into a rusty lock, and you didn't care if the keys broke so long as the lock got sprung. So why treat people any differently than you would treat barnyard animals? So Gowdy survives the war. He survives Pershing. He survives the disinterest of the political and military masters. And he survives the latrines. And then he goes back to the Braves. And whereas the Braves were a good enough team to win a surprise World Series in 1914, with Gowdy going absolutely nuts during the World Series, he went 6 for 11, that's 545, with 3 doubles, a triple, and a home run. They were not so great for a long time thereafter. And as I said before, in 1923, he gets traded over to the Giants, who are in the middle of a pennant-winning stretch, 1921 through 1924. And they trade a couple of pretty good players for him, too. Another catcher, Oil Smith, who had the disadvantage of just openly hating Giants manager John McGraw, and the pitcher, Jesse Petty. Gowdy didn't play all that much in the 1923 World Series when the Giants lost to the Yankees for the first time. But in 1924, the Giants repeated as pennant winners and went off to play the Washington Senators. Gowdy played every game because the regular catcher, Poncho Snyder, was hurt. This was a really tense series, almost perfect, in that the two teams alternated victories. So it went Giants, Senators, Giants, Senators, Giants, Senators through 6. Now, the seventh game is still well remembered, and it came up a lot in 2018 during the baseball season because, in a then novel strategy, Senators player manager Bucky Harris used an opener in the final game. It was a ruse to trick John McGraw into removing Bill Terry, a platoon player, from the game early. Terry was a left-handed hitter, and he was absolutely killing the Senators in the series, and so Harris started Curly Ogden, a right-hander, pulled him pretty much right off for George Mogridge, a left-hander, and McGraw went for the okey-doke and pulled Terry from the game after just a couple of plate appearances. Even with all that chicanery, the game was still tied at the end of 9, 3 apiece, and went to extra innings. Now I want to introduce just one more character, Earl McNeely, who was a journeyman kind of guy, just 5'9", not much of a bat, who was pressed into midseason service as the Senators' center fielder. They had great outfielders on the corners in Goose Goslin and Sam Rice, both of whom would later go to the Hall of Fame, deservedly so. But the initial center fielder was one of the clean Sox, Nemo Leibold, and he didn't really do all that much well. So the owner, Clark Griffith, pulled McNeely out of the Pacific Coast League. Later on, he'd go back and actually own the Sacramento Solons, which was a PCL franchise for a long time, and Griffith didn't really know what he was getting. In the short term, he guessed right. McNeely got hot and hit 330 down the stretch for the Senators, or the Nats as they were sometimes called. But thereafter, he proved himself to be a fairly terrible hitter. He had no power whatsoever. Did I mention he was only 5'9"? He hit 4 home runs in 683 games. Now, he spent quite a number of those games in Washington's Griffith Park, which was a tough, tough home run environment. But he spent many other games in Sportsman's Park playing for the Browns, which was such a bandbox that they had to put up a special chain-link fence across the grandstand to keep the ball within the boundaries. He played mostly right field for the Browns and started in 1928 and hit .236 with a .299 on-base percentage, and slugged .319. As you know, that would not be great from a shortstop. It's really, really bad from a corner outfielder. The next year, in more of a part-time role, as was appropriate, he hit .243 with a .272 on base and slugged only .300, despite hitting the sole home run of his Browns tenure. Put those two seasons together, and they are worth, as per Baseball Reference, minus -2.7 wins above replacement. This was a really, really, at least at that point, bad player. That's in the future, though. Let's go now to Game 7 of the 1924 World Series, bottom of the 12th. Honored military veteran Hank Gowdy catching for the Giants. His opposite number, Muddy Rule, a lawyer when not catching or coaching, bats with one out and pops the ball up behind the plate. It's in play and Gowdy goes after it. You've seen this a million times, so picture it in your mind. When the catcher has a play to make, he takes off his mask and what does he do? He throws it as far from himself as humanly possible. In one of Ron Luciano's umpiring books, he complains that certain catchers, taking out their frustrations on the umpires, would aim the catcher's mask at the umpires themselves. That was not the case here. In fact, it was the opposite, because Gowdy didn't throw it very far at all. So he scrambles after Rule's pop-up, steps in his mask, and falls down. He said later it was like being in a bear trap. The ball dropped. Rule was given another chance at life, and he doubled to left field. Now Walter Johnson, pitching in relief for the Senators, came to bat. He was a pretty good hitter for a pitcher, and he batted for himself, and God knows he was going to be in there all day if this thing kept going on. A lot of this World Series was about winning one for the big train, because the Senators had been mostly lame for most of his career. This was perceived to be his last best chance. He pulled the ball to Giants shortstop Travis Jackson, who bobbled it. Now, there were runners on first and second because Rule, with the play in front of him and him being a typically sluggardly catcher, held his place at second base. The lineup turned over, and it brought up McNeely. McNeely hit what should have been an out to third baseman Freddie Lindstrom, but the ball hit a pebble and bounded away hippity-hop down the left field line. The left fielder was Irish Musial, a very good hitter, an indifferent defender, sometimes by reputation an indifferent player overall. Usually McGraw subbed him out for defense late and close, but he hadn't done that this time. This was McGraw's last trip to the World Series, and as you can tell, he was perhaps not having his best mental acuity season, and in fact, he was not to have too many more great mental acuity seasons. A lot of drinking with McGraw, a lot of premature aging. Musial got to the ball fairly quickly, and it was Rule running from second. He had, as I mentioned, a catcher speed, so it was felt there was a play at the plate, but for whatever reason, Musial just pocketed the ball, didn't throw home, and the World Series was over. Lindstrom got to wear the goat's horns. There was another bad hop grounder past him that also had tied the game and sent it into extras. And Gowdy, well, his place was kind of mixed. Some writers said that, yes, he had screwed up and cost the Giants the game. But others, well, let me put it this way. In February of 1925, that is before the next season had started, before spring training had really kicked off, the New York Herald Tribune published an op-ed headlined, "Hank Gowdy Wins the Respect of a Million Baseball Fans." There was no real reason to have published it. Nothing had changed between Game 7 of the World Series and February 1st of the following year. And yet, the Herald Tribune felt motivated to go all in on Gowdy. The great dream of an average boy is to be a World Series hero. Hank Gowdy had that dream come true. Back in 1914, he was catcher for the Boston Nationals, and his bat had a lot to do with the never-to-be-forgotten triumph of the Braves over Connie Mack's famous Athletic. A great man was Gowdy 10 years ago. 10 years later, this same Gowdy, gnarled and wrinkled and seamed and slowed down by time, again came forward to catch every game in a World Series. He rubbed the dimness from his eyes with a grimy knuckle, and his heart surged within him at the call and pumped fresh blood from some unknown reservoir into that old frame, and lo, again, Hank Gowdy wielded a mighty, if not a winning bat, in a series. He batted 545 in the series of 1914. He batted 260 in the series of 1924. He was counted the most dependable and the most dangerous of all the New York batsmen in the struggle. They named Hank Gowdy from the Washington stands during that last series, named him the best name of all, and for all time, when they called out to him every time he came to bat from the midst of a partisan throng that was solidly against his team, good old Hank. No finer testimonial can a public character have than this. It expresses not alone mere admiration for mere skill and prowess, it designates also an affection that is warm and deep and true. Admiration wanes, but affection grows stronger with the years. Can I borrow from E.E. Cummings here and say he spoke quickly and drank a glass of water when Gowdy lays the catcher's mitt away for the last time and goes back to his old hometown of Columbus, Ohio to stay. He will carry with him the affections of a million fans. He was not alone a great catcher, a timely batsman, and a player of stamina and strength. He was the fine and loved characters of the game. Skip paragraph. But Hank's main hold upon public affections came from his war record. This player was the first to go. He threw his mask and mitt to the nettles, snapped his fingers at a big league salary and career. Ha ha! And enlisted as a private and saw active service in France. And this in a day when most professional athletes were holding back to the last hour and then seeking the shipyards. Sergeant Hank Gowdy is a title as proud and high as that of almost any general you could name to the American boy. Yes, and to that boy's father also. Skipping a few more paragraphs in the same vein, getting to the end here, Hank stepped on his mask in a crisis of the seventh game and missed a foul ball that gave Washington another chance and the series. But this mishap cannot dim the grand old scout's record. Marshall Ney was beaten at Waterloo, but a century afterward, he was still called the bravest of the brave. Old Hank will always be ranked by competent and thoughtful students of the game, along with Matty and Walter Johnson and Anson and Ty Cobb, rare types whose character and playing skill mark them as immortals of the game. The Hall of Fame was not my point in bringing all of this up, but really, are we so much smarter than the observers of the time who apparently just worshipped this man and felt that he deserved to be mentioned in the same breath as Christy Mathewson and Walter Johnson and Ty Cobb? We can put Harold Baines and Jim Rice and Tony Perez in the Hall of Fame, but say we're much smarter than those dudes from 95 years ago? I don't think so. But my greater point is a more cosmic one. Hank Gowdy put himself through hell for his country's benefit, endured all the humiliations and risks that I described to you earlier, and yet the World Series, or the Universe, or the Universe's World Series, had one more humiliation for him in store. And yes, he got something of a pass for that. But it feels somehow wrong, cosmically unfair. One could survive the Argonne Forest, could successfully execute the very difficult and dangerous business of flanking German machine gun nests hidden behind trees and barbed wire in that deep, dark wood, and yet forget to throw his mask far enough away, a kind of fundamental of the game that perhaps hadn't fully evolved yet, but still step in his own mask, blow a World Series game in Bill Buckner style, and have to live with just that one more thing on your mind. But I'm not telling you anything you don't know. The scales don't balance. It's all about chance. And he just as well could have not gone and still tripped over his own equipment. Or alternatively, the scales do balance. He used up all his good luck and good karma surviving. And the rest of it, well, that was on his own dime. I will let you mull that over while we take a break. I have one more tale for you before I turn you over to your New Year's celebration. So one last reminder, keep an eye out for They Shall Not Grow Old when it returns. When you see it, drop me a line either at the Infinite Inning address or in the Facebook group. Let me know what you thought. And as you're watching and listening, remember that Hank Gowdy went through that stuff too.
Johnny, get your gun. Take it on the run. Hear them calling you and me, everyone for liberty.
This is George M. Cohan's song, Over There, explicitly written for the war effort in 1917 and debuted here by Nora Bays, who had a hit with it. Here's one more bit of interconnection. She was married to Jack Norworth, the lyricist of Take Me Out to the Ballgame.
Over.
We're headed into January, not traditionally the most happening month for baseball, but that may be changing as free agent and trade decisions have come to be negotiated with more nervousness, more delicacy than the Brexit agreement, possibly for the reason that there is proportionately just as much money at stake, particularly if you're making a long commitment. I hear Dallas Keuchel wants 5 years. I want 5 years too, Dallas. Never mind 5 years. I want just a minute more, just a single minute, and maybe a last meal. Anyway, unlike Brexit, I don't know that Bryce Harper will run out of essential medicines and vaccines if he signs with the wrong organization. But you never know. And if you choose poorly, if you choose a team that opts for a sudden rebuild right after committing all their dough to you, you may find yourself in roughly the equivalent baseball position of being the Ralph Kiner on the 1952 Pirates, kind of an island, a Statue of Liberty in the harbor. But there's actually nothing around the harbor. They took Manhattan and traded it for three players to be named later. That's the kind of thing I actually want to talk about, because sometimes interesting baseball things do happen in January. I note that we will very shortly observe the 7th anniversary of the January 6th trade that brought Anthony Rizzo from San Diego to Chicago in exchange for Andrew Cashner and the immortal Kyungmin Na. I'm sure you will light a candle for that, but I want to go a little further back to the 1930s and a topic that we, by which I mean you and I, discussed in a different context about a year ago. This would have been in episode 39. I didn't get into some specific moves associated with that story then that I would like to discuss now. This came to mind today because as I record this, Sears may or may not be liquidated, but regardless, we'll close yet more stores, and shares of JCPenney's dropped below a dollar on Wednesday, and they stuck there, probably with good reason. So some venerable American brands are in mortal jeopardy, and that, of course, suggests some baseball brands that, too, have been in mortal jeopardy. And as we well know, history repeats, and some stories are not stories of old times, but all times. And so I take you to the Hanging Gardens of Babylon in the year 600 BC. Just kidding. We're going to Philadelphia in the 1930s. On January 4th, 1936, the Philadelphia A's, owned and operated by manager Connie Mack, traded outfielder Doc Flit Kramer and shortstop Eric Boob McNair to the Boston Red Sox for pitcher Hank Johnson, middle infielder Al Nemeiak, and $175,000. Parenthetically, I have no clue if I'm pronouncing Al Nemeiak correctly. His name was spelled N-I-E-M-I-E-C-M-O-U-S-E. I really don't know. It could be Niemiec. That doesn't sound right. I don't know. I'm a provincial American, and how everyone else pronounces their names is a mystery to me. You can say mine backwards, and I couldn't fault you. Neither of these were great players. McNair was a glove for a shortstop with occasional pop for a middle infielder of the period. He once led the American League in doubles with 47 in 1932. He reached double-figure home runs three times in his career. Again, a lot for a shortstop at the time, but not great offense for particularly the early 1930s when the ball was notoriously rabbity. Kramer wasn't a star, at least by our lights, but people at the time thought so. He was a five-time All-Star. He hit 300 pretty regularly. It was the softest 300, perhaps, in baseball history, at least on a career basis, because he had zero power and he didn't walk. What he was just very good at doing was banging out single after single after single, and he was often considered a leadoff man, so he got a ton of at-bats, which means that he banged out a ton of those singles. And he had a great defensive reputation. That nickname, Flit, refers to the insecticide. I don't know if it's still around, but one of the things that Dr. Seuss got his career started doing, in addition to drawing editorial cartoons, was drawing ads for Flit, in which people would pump DDT at these bizarre Susian insects over or below the slogan, "Quick, Henry, the flit." There's a pretty good book of baseball nicknames or explanations therefore by a fellow named James Skipper, and I by no means mean to impugn his work, which has been a useful reference to me on many occasions when, for example, I might not be sure why Eric Boob McNair was in fact a boob. But he did not know this about Flit, that both Doc Kramer and Flit were death to flying things. And so he offered this strangely circular explanation. I read directly from the text. Teammates called him Flit. He extinguished fly balls in the outfield just like a flit. But that is not a thing. That is, what is a flit? It is not a rare breed of hawk or anything like that. But look, my books have some mistakes in them too. Sometimes you're rushing and you miss things. Regardless, by any other name, this trade was poisonous to both teams. The Red Sox spent a lot of money for players who were overrated, and the A's lost at least the perception of talent, which was a problem because in this period, they had already traded so much. And if the Red Sox were buying at the bottom of the actual talent barrel, it's because the actual talent had already been dispersed. Tom Yawkey had come into a vast mining and mineral rights inheritance in the early 30s and used a part of it, a small part apparently, to pick up the Red Sox, who had been derelict for forever, or at least since Harry Frazee had disassembled the team and shipped it to New York. Well, Yawkey was looking to rebuild the Red Sox quickly. And if he was poor in veteran talent to trade, which is how it is often done, he was rich in actual cash, which everyone needed at the time, it being the Great Depression, and few owners needed more so than Connie Mack. When the stock market crashed in 1929, Mr. Mack took a bath. And as a result, and this is the part that I talked about way back in episode 39, he was in a similar position to the Wilpons after the Madoff losses hit them, in that he didn't want to sell out, but he really couldn't afford to stay and put the money into the team that he had been heretofore putting in. Now, the fair thing to the fans in both cases would be to sell out, get what you can, make yourself whole, and skedaddle in favor of someone who does have the resources to field a quality major league club for your market. But no, that didn't happen. So what he looked to do was deal off his player assets, and the A's, who were very, very good at this time, they had won consecutive pennants, 29, 1930, 1931, and won the World Series in two of those years, certainly had the player depth to sell, but simultaneously not the player depth to replace them, not unless they acquired the replacements in the deals themselves. But A, as you know, that's almost impossible. It's very, very hard when you're dealing a top-level player, say as the Orioles dealt Manny Machado this year. You're not necessarily, or I should say it's very unlikely, that you're going to get equivalent talent back. If the acquiring team had the equivalent talent, they wouldn't need to acquire Manny Machado. Or they have what might turn into Manny Machado someday, but, as is the way with all prospects, almost certainly won't. And B, as we've already seen, talent was not the point of these trades. In the deal that sent Kramer and McNair to Boston, Hank Johnson was a veteran pitcher, just at best a league average kind of guy, and Nemiak, however you say his name, Nemiak, was not really even a prospect. He was just a guy, one who was going on 25, and when he did get his chance that next season with the A's, he played in 69 games, got 235 plate appearances, hit 197 with a 291 on base and a 246 slugging percentage, and even the A's, as downtrodden as they were done with him. His career has an interesting postscript because he went back to the minors, ended up serving in World War II, not in combat, I believe, but in a phys ed kind of role, as many players did, But when he got out of the service, he attempted to use the GI Bill of Rights to reclaim his roster spot with the Seattle Rainiers of the Pacific Coast League. The government very wisely took a look at history and saw that one problem that many countries have had in the aftermath of wars was that as soon as it's all over, you tend to unleash a whole bunch of frustrated young men who have, until very recently, been killing other humans with high efficiency on the countryside, and you are going to tell them to look for jobs that other people have already replaced them in. And even in this country, with its devotion to democratic ideals, at least in theory, that problem has led to uprisings at different times. Going back to the Revolutionary War, there's a reason that Congress met in Princeton and not Philadelphia for a while, and that's because the veterans took Philadelphia. They took their muskets and their funny hats, and they came for Congress because they wanted to get paid. Similarly, what had destabilized many countries in the interwar period, again, veterans who felt very disappointed in the outcome of the war, had no money, there was a depression on, which redoubled the pain of that. In the United States, we had the Bonus Army, which is another example of the kind of thing that we're talking about, although it was a peaceful protest, no matter how much Herbert Hoover and Douglas MacArthur. You know what? I'm digressing even more than I usually digress. The point being that the government tried to make sure that didn't happen by giving returning servicemen a right to reclaim their old jobs. This presented a problem for baseball because in the 4 years that you might have been gone fighting the war, you got 4 years older. Maybe you weren't that good in the first place. Maybe your reflexes are just never going to come back. And hell, they've acquired Derek Jeter and he's now playing your position. They are not going to reverse that process. So Nemiak ends up in court. That was the most interesting thing about him. As a prospect, he had great legal potential. He's a future 60 on the 2080 plaintiff scale, but even that was 10 years away. No, the two players were throw-ins on the main star that the A's acquired, which was the $175,000. This wasn't the only trade of that nature that Mac made in the period. He wanted more than $175,000. Who doesn't? And the Yawkey Mac transactions, or possibly we should call them the Eddie Collins Mac transactions, since Mac's old pal was Boston's general manager in this period, really destroyed his franchise because all the moves are similarly dead-ended. They all end in money, and money is great, but if you don't reinvest it in the franchise, you've just emptied the shelves of ballplayers, and there's nothing there to replace them. And so, on December 12, 1933, the A's sent second baseman Max Camera Eye Bishop and starting pitchers Rube Wahlberg and one Robert Lefty Grove to Boston for a sub-replacement-level pitcher Bob Klein and hitless shortstop Rabbit Wurstler, and, inevitably, $125,000. Almost exactly 2 years later, on December 10th, 1935, the A's sent first baseman Jimmy Fox and pitcher Johnny Markham to the Red Sox for pitcher Gordon Rhodes, catcher George Savino, and $150,000. Savino never got out of the minors, and Rhodes went 9-20 with a 5.74 ERA in 1936, and like Nemiak, that was the end of that. During that same period, Mac traded, and we've talked about this too, catcher Mickey Cochran to the Tigers for backup catcher Johnny Pasek and $100,000. He dealt three-time 20-game winner George Earnshaw and Pasek to the White Sox for backup catcher Charlie Berry and $20,000. And outright sold Al Simmons and Mulehaus, both outfielders, plus super sub Jimmy Dykes, who became the White Sox manager in short order, for another $100,000. So total this up, and you have four future Hall of Famers, and not Harold Baines guys either, but really big stars, leaving town over a period of about 4 years, and in return, the A's got Johnson, Nemiak, Klein, Wurstler, Rhodes, Savino, and Berry, plus $670,000 in 1930s money. And so, I suppose, Mrs. Mack got that new hat and her in-ground swimming pool. As for the ball club itself, Mack didn't have the money or the inclination to build a farm system. As I said, this was money for him, not money for the club. He was not big, as the 30s passed into the 40s, on integration. And so the club was on an incredibly weak footing. Plus, as of 1933, he turned 70, the blood flow to his head wasn't great, and his sons, who were increasingly involved in running the team and arguing over who got what in the event that Dad kicked it, were kind of the Donald and Eric Trump of their era. There were three of them, actually, but the third got bought out and told to screw off. And so, as a result, there was just no digging out of this hole that Mac had created. The club had this little dead cat bounce in the late 40s, 47, 48, 49, got off to good starts in those years and had respectable, somewhat interesting teams, but it was too late at that point. The Phillies were no more progressive on race than Mac was. In fact, their 1950 pennant-winning team, which lost to the Yankees in the World Series, was the last in history to win a pennant with a completely white squad. However, they had done a very good job of building a farm system, and they became just the more attractive entertainment option. Those momentarily sorta resurgent A's teams that I mentioned a few minutes ago, they were particularly on the offense old. There were some decently young pitchers on there, but as good as players like Eddie Joost and Hank Majeski and Barney McCoskey, I feel like I'm singing Van Lingle Mungo by Dave Frischberg. But as good as those players were, Sam Chapman, he's another one, they weren't old, but they were older. And you had gotten used to them or bored of them. You knew what their limitations were. Whereas Richie Ashburn and Del Ennis and Granny Hamner and Robin Roberts, they were young. They were seemingly building towards something, and it turned out that something really didn't last that long, but still, their future was clearly in front of them. And so, Connie Mack permanently damaged his brand, and when Head and West became an attractive option for ball club, his sons chose to take the exit, somewhat against his will, I think. But they were probably right that the goodwill had gone. It really shouldn't have happened. The Phillies had been so bad for so long, and the A's mostly good, or at least good for two discrete periods, bookended by periods of misery, that you'd think it was the Phillies that would have had to re-earn people's trust, and found that an impossible task, given that they'd essentially given up on that starting in 1915. But no, life is sometimes about what have you done for me lately. And so it turns out that yes, you can destroy something that was seemingly impervious and rooted. I started out talking about JCPenney's and Sears. Some of what has happened to them is bad decisions made by management, just as Mac, pushed to the wall by exigency and his empty wallet, made bad decisions. Some of it is that the department store business has been dying for 50 years, and then the internet came along and just put a stake through its heart. But I think the similarity with Mac is that they just stopped offering their constituency an interesting enough reason to go there. One irony, it seems to me, is that during the height of the department store era, when life was slower, they expected you to go, I think particularly women at that time, but they expected you to go and make a day of it. And so if you look at the original Wanamakers in Philadelphia, they pampered you from the moment you walked in the door. They took your coat. They had a tea room. They had a fancy restaurant. They had all kinds of distractions that would just keep you in the building and adding stuff to your shopping list whenever you'd stop drinking tea long enough to pull something off the rack. Times changed and they went away from those things. But it turns out that that kind of service is something that the internet cannot offer. And in our increasingly isolated, suburbanized lives, we lack meeting places. And so had they gone back to that kind of thing, had they cornered fast enough to understand the way that business was changing, perhaps they would have retained a smaller market share, a different market share, but still people would have been coming through the doors and buying something.
I don't think that's wholly what happened with the A's, though, failing to shift with the changing times. It was certainly part of it. But it also might have been a lot simpler than that, that in tearing down that wonderful team from 1929 to 1931 and making fans look at those players scattered all over the league, he broke some essential covenant between himself and the fans. Maybe something like this has happened in your town. I live in the suburbs, and it's a culinary null zone. I live in a very diverse area, and if you draw a circle around my location and the radius anywhere from 15 to 20 miles, you inevitably find some very good restaurants. Every little town has a quaint breakfast joint that makes a killer waffle or a faux French bistro for coffee and sandwiches, and a Chinese restaurant that the locals swear by. My town has four Dunkin' Donuts all about a mile apart, and lately we've gotten chains like Red Robin and Bar Louie, which are so spectacularly bad, I can't figure out quite how they stay in business, how they metastasized at the national level. And I know some of you will like that kind of thing, and I don't mean to criticize you for that. I don't. It's that I long ago, way back in college, in fact, realized that my money matters to me. I mean, not in a miserly von Stroheim greed kind of way, but just in the sense that if I'm going to spend it for food or entertainment, I actually expect to receive some pleasure out of it. And if you go to a restaurant and are abused in some sense, whether because of the quality of the food or the quality of the service, that's not something that should be acceptable. It is your money, and you can spend it in a lot of ways. And in the United States, there's a certain quality of chain restaurant that bills itself as being better than fast food, but less than roadkill. I don't know, but if you see the ads on television, they sell themselves on the quality of the experience. You'll have fun with ribs and alcohol and so forth. But really, if you're having fun, you're bringing that aspect of it with you in who you're going with. Unless you're drinking by yourself at the bar at Applebee's, in which case we need to have a conversation about the trajectory of your life. I'm digressing as usual, but what happened was that my town, for all of its culinary deficits, had a few options that for a long time you could rely on. There was a solid Chinese takeout, there was a quality sushi restaurant, and a good if unspectacular diner. But the takeout changed ownership. Actually, all three, to make a spectacularly long story short, changed ownership, and in each case, the quality declined. The diner the last time I went had a variety of insect wildlife crawling over the salad bar to an extent that made me want to shout, "Is there an entomologist in the house?" And I thought, surely it must just be me, because as I swiveled my head around me, I saw seemingly happy diners swishing their tails at the flies buzzing around their heads, but otherwise paying no attention and happily chowing down. Perhaps they'd just been conditioned by those same low-quality institutions that I mentioned. I thought, it must surely be me. It must be that I'm a hypercritical baseball guy. But no, I went to Yelp, and there were many other people asking what had happened to these three formerly quality choices and warning people gently to stay away, which left us now with a batting average of zero. And I think that's what happened with Connie Mack and the A's, except that the Philadelphia fans had another alternative, and so the Phillies are still there. But he had degraded that relationship between himself and the fans, had left them asking what had happened to this thing that we used to like but doesn't give us what we want now at the level that we want it. And eventually, he had to move, which really means that for the Philadelphia fans, even if the corporate entity lived on in Missouri and then subsequently in Oakland, California, functionally, they had put it out of business. And of course, I can't prove that precisely, but I was thinking about Mac's response to beat writer questions over the Doc Kramer deal that I began this discussion with. They're purely contemptuous of the fans. This was in the Philadelphia Inquirer the next day. The writer, one James Isminger, asked Mac why he had made that trade. "I will not say a word," he replied. As to why I made these deals, you can draw your own conclusions. Isminger followed up, what are your plans for the team in 1936? I am not going to announce any plans at any time. Do you intend to trade any more of your star players? I won't answer that. I could if I cared. I might sell or trade anybody I have, for that matter. Then you won't say anything about what the A's will look like next season? Not a word. My partners and I have agreed on this. We're going to keep you all guessing. For the rest of the offseason, I am not going to tell anybody what players I will have next season. The only way you will know about any of my prospective players is when you see them working out at the training camp next March. Okay, said Isminger. So what you're saying is that the A's don't want any publicity at all? No, was Mac's answer. And this is a hell of a way to sell tickets. Stoke interest in the club. Imagine if the Dodgers held a press conference, or an anti-press conference, as it was in this case, and the reporter said, so did you sign Bryce Harper or did you not? We're not telling. You'll have to buy some tickets to find out. Please don't reveal the secret ending to your friends. You want them to experience the surprise, the shocking denouement, the same way that you did. And then, of course, you buy the tickets, and the answer is no, they didn't sign Bryce Harper. And in fact, they're not signing anyone ever again. I suspect if an ownership tried really hard, they could do to their team what Mac did to his. Fans do always seem to come back when a team starts trying again after years of punting. The A's fans even did for Mac just a little bit when the team had this little dead cat bounce resurgence in the late 40s. But that was also an artifact of the immediate post-war period. People just wanted to see some quality baseball after doing without for many years and, of course, having to restrict even their most basic travel due to things like tire rationing and gas rationing. So there was a certain novelty in just going. But since the A's never actually won anything after 1931, they never gave the fans a real chance to resubscribe to their loyalties. By the time the A's got good again, it was decades later and two cities on. And we shouldn't take for granted what happened to them. The big leagues look immutable now, but that's just because we live in an illusion we call the present. Combine a few factors, an economic downturn, say, demographic change in the host city, and an ownership that's broken faith with the fans one too many times, and it might turn out that one of our present franchises had sold itself out cheap. I don't care to speculate exactly on which team that would be. I think that clubs like the Rays and the Marlins are in a slightly different category. They are perhaps teams where Major League Baseball just doesn't necessarily belong, at least not as a butts in seats kind of enterprise. People will argue with you that, gosh, they're very well supported on television, or at least better supported on television, and I don't feel wholly qualified to support or refute those arguments. But I was thinking about the Cleveland club. It's coming off of three consecutive postseason appearances, just like the A's were in 1931. But as we speak now, midway through the winter, a lot could still happen. But at the moment, they have an outfield of the Scarecrow, the Tin Man, and the Wogglebug. And that could change, but they also might trade Corey Kluber or Trevor Bauer. The latest story suggests that no, they're not going to do that. But again, there's a lot of distance to go between now and spring training, and they might yet change their mind. Cleveland has the second highest poverty rate in the United States as it empties out into the suburbs and the exurbs and the orbiting space platforms. I guess we'll call those the astroburbs. Before their current run, back in 2015, they drew 17,000 a game, and they beat the Rays in attendance, and only the Rays in the American League. So if you think about it, it could happen. And if you go back to the history of that franchise, particularly in its extreme doldrums of the 1970s, there was a lot of conversation that it was headed out of town. And I don't know if it came quite as close as the Padres going to Washington. I think that was the occasion in which Topps actually put out cards with Washington Padres on them basically going into the next season because it seemed like such a sure thing. And the Giants were headed for Canada at one point, and that was just barely headed off. It could happen. As I said, we tend to look at the time we're living in as one of stability, but often when you pull back the camera on any discrete period of time, and of course those endpoints are arbitrary, but you'll see that things are shifting and shaking constantly, and chances are stability is an illusion in every aspect of our lives. And that, Gladys, is why I don't think it's wise to spend $20,000 renovating the bathrooms, okay? Well, there's a cheery thought for the new year, but I do believe it's true. I wouldn't lie to you. This is almost certainly a non sequitur, but over the last few weeks, in what is clearly a manifestation of my ongoing midlife crisis, I picked up some old boxes of trading cards I had abandoned in my parents' basement and started assembling some sets from my high school days. I say trading cards and not baseball cards because I inadvertently pulled not just the top sets that I wanted to play with, but all kinds of other cards from when I was much younger. Cards that were sold to exploit Star Wars and Battlestar Galactica, Grease and Elvis, and TV shows like Welcome Back, Cotter, and Mork and Mindy. You know, the Sopranos of their day. The way that last category of cards worked was that they would take a still shot from the show and then paste a comic book style word balloon over it to create some truly insipid sub-sitcom humor. Can you hear the question marks in my voice around humor? If you're familiar with the form of comic books which utilize photographs rather than illustrations, often called fumetti, the cards are one panel fumetti. This worked well enough for Welcome Back, Cotter, where the main character, the main actor, Gabe Kaplan, tended to make these cheesy old vaudeville-style jokes anyway. So you could just write a lame one-liner for the cards that would have sounded okay coming out of Henny Youngman's mouth. But for Mork and Mindy, they had the initial challenge of trying to capture the anarchic humor of Robin Williams, or as much of it as was allowed to bleed through the insipid sitcom scripts. And as I was separating these old novelties from the Topps cards I was trying to find, I came across one in which Pam Dauber, who was the Mindy of the equation, was trying to catch Williams, who was apparently in the act of collapsing for whatever plot reason that episode of the show had going on. And her word bubble, her word balloon says, "Are you okay?" And Williams replies, "Well, it only hurts when I furp." F-U-R-R-P. Exclamation point. You see, the humor, such as it was that Williams was playing an alien, and I don't mean the kind of alien that the president hates, but one from outer space, and, well, he had a different vocabulary, and you just swapped words out one for one, and hilarity ensued, sort of, if you're generous about things. But for some reason, I can't get this out of my mind, and the only response I can think of is similar to a very old joke, also a Henny Youngman-style joke. A man goes into a doctor's office and says, "Doctor, it hurts when I do this." And the doctor says, "Then for God's sake, don't do that." Rimshot, or sad trombone, or something. And so, to bring all of this together, I guess what I'm trying to say is that Connie Mack furped his franchise. And if it only hurts when you furp, well, don't furp. Build when you're winning. Ride for as long as you can, because you don't know when you're going to get back on that merry-go-round again. Mac never did. And he who spins a contender into an unmotivated rebuild to make a few dollars more will soon make many dollars less, because the fans will tell him to go furp himself. And on that note, dear friends, I withdraw from the proceedings for the remainder of 2018. In other words, further deponent saith not, except perhaps for this. Happy New Year, everybody. As I often say before we take a break, I'll see you on the other side. In this instance, the other side is 2019. Hang in there, won't you? By the bleached bones of our disillusionment, we have come to the end of another episode and another year. It is my pleasure to welcome our latest patrons to the infinite inning, infinite roll of honor. Michael Farron, Nishant Menon, Joe Pritchard, Jeremy Tice, Larry Glosh, Dina Slavensky,
and Michael Fenger. Thank you so very much.
No guests this week, so you can't follow them on Twitter, but you can follow me at Go Stephen Goldman. Why Go Stephen Goldman? Because it's what all the cool jazz cats say when I start my hot trombone solo. Go Stephen Goldman. You can also write us, by which I mean me, at infiniteinning@gmail.com. And there's a Facebook group. Go to Facebook, search Infinite Inning, knock. I will let you in. It's BYOB, unless you're OBE. As you just heard, you can now support the show via Patreon. Go to patreon.com/theinfiniteinning, and eventually we'll be able to put chrome fins on this thing. Finally, if you have a spare moment, please go to the podcatcher of your choice, Apple, iTunes, or what have you, and rate, review, and subscribe. It helps promote the show. And if your podcatcher doesn't let you do those things, find a bathroom wall and scrawl the information on there. Our theme song, which you are hearing now and have in fact been listening to throughout the episode, is called The Infinite Man. It was a co-composition of myself and Dr. Rick Mooring, who is ready and willing to explain integrated circuits to you, but only after he heals up from his extended bout of Cool Ranch Doritos. Well, if the cow doesn't misunderstand the cat's offer to do a little hey diddle diddling under the light of the moon and is so offended that she won't jump, causing me to not have enough whipped cream to top my famous Jersey cream pie, I'll be back next week with more tales and discussion from inside the Infinite Inning.